Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York, but we are sitting in Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's Restaurant, and you are listening to Chef's Story. And today, we're really fortunate. We have a young, gorgeous, very popular chef from New York City, George Mendez, from the famous Aldea restaurant. I probably said that wrong.
Aldea.
Right. But let me tell you about this guy. I mean, you know, first of all, in 2011, he was named one of the best new chefs by Food and Wine magazine. Aldea has a 1-star rating from the Michelin Guide. Aldea's been named, and I know this for sure, one of the country's 10 best new restaurants by Alan Richman, because George, Alan actually took me there when he was raiding the restaurant, and he was just raving about your food.
Wow, that's
I mean,
a rarity.
And as did Frank Bruni in the New York Times. You've been a New York Rising Star Chef from Star Chefs, nominated for Best Chef in New York from the Beard Foundation. So I think that people get it. You're a hot chef. you're here today, and I just can't wait to find out. You're so young. How did all this happen? Tell me about it.
It's humbling. I don't know how to answer that. I started right out of high school. You know, my parents were immigrants from Portugal, and they basically said, you don't need to go to this college. You don't need to do this or that. They just says, you know, find something that you love, work hard, make money, and just be happy. And coincidentally,
great parents.
coincidentally, there was a field trip while I was in high school in marketing class to the Culinary Institute of America, and I went and spent the day there, and I was just mesmerized, and I knew that I wanted to do something with my hands. I was very athletic. I didn't want to do anything where I sat at a desk from 9 to 5. So I was attracted to the kitchens, all these people were walking around and cooking wearing these tall white hats. You know, I was 17 years old. I was like, it was exciting. Mm-hmm. And I saw mm-hmm. the attention to detail, the sense of urgency.
But wait a minute, when you were little, did you love to eat? Was that one of your favorite things?
Oh, yeah.
Was your mom a good cook? What is Portuguese cooking? I mean, you know.
Oh, that's a whole...
What did you bring to school did you bring your lunch to school?
Yes.
What did your mom, make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
Occasionally, but one thing that I had very often was a chorizo and parsley omelet that my mom would make and cut it up and put it in between white toast. Granted, I ate it when it was cold lunchtime, but it was a very unique sandwich in comparison to what everybody else was eating. That's for
what
sure.
Did the other kids look at it?
Probably, I don't really recall, but all I know is I look around and there definitely were Twinkies and Yodels and all that stuff around me, which I also had occasionally. But, you know, to answer your question, I grew up around a lot of good cooking by my mom, my dad, my aunts. And that's, I think, what planted the seed mm-hmm. early on. Mm-hmm. My mom cooked a home meal 5 to 6 days a week. Mm. You know, and as a kid, you know, you discover the fast food chains like McDonald's and all that. But I grew up eating rice dishes and salt cod, which back then I hated and it was stinky and salty, but I didn't know it would have such an impact in my career later on today. But, you know, suckling pig, baby goat, all these shellfish preparations. Then the holidays would come around and it would be my aunt and my mom prepping for 2 days prior for a big Thanksgiving feast. And the turkey
for Thanksgiving
and Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and New Year's and New Year's Day and even the 4th of July was a lavish banquet. So since my baby years, it was surrounded by food.
Wow. So and, were you in the kitchen with your mom, or were you just the good eater?
I'd make breakfast occasionally. I remember making pancakes, instant pancakes, Aunt Jemima, out of, you know, the ready-to-go frozen thing.
Oh, yeah, oh, the Jemima frozen shirt. Thing. The just frozen putting thing. It in the yeah. toaster? You didn't
no,
even
no,
put
no,
the
no.
egg
it was
in the mix.
Frozen. It was like a pint-sized thing where you defrost it, and it was instant pancake batter.
Oh.
And that was my first experience with putting a pan on the heat, adding butter, melting the butter, and making pancakes.
I see.
And then toasted and scrambled eggs. So, you know, that started early age with my sister.
Ah, all right. So, so you were, it wasn't that you were 10 years old and saying, I want to be a chef when I grow up.
No.
What did you want to be when you were 10 years old?
A basketball player.
Oh,
yes.
That's good.
I was very athletic. I played.
Were you tall for 10?
Hell no. They called me Spud Webb. I mean, I was the part of the shortest. I mean, I played shooting guard. But yeah, I definitely had Larry Bird dreams until my dad said to me one day, basketball is not going to make you money, son. And it was like a shot to the gut. And I was like, whoa, okay, thanks. What am I going to do?
Really? I mean, you were that serious.
Yeah,
that
I took it to heart. I did want to play basketball. Mm-hmm. I honestly did. And I was played right up
were
until junior high school. I thought I was pretty damn good. I was a shooting guard. I thought I
you
was
grew up
okay.
in Connecticut, right?
I grew up in Danbury, Connecticut, and then Bethel, Connecticut.
Uh-huh. And so now your basketball dreams are shattered.
Now I just watch basketball.
Now you watch it. But you were how old when he told you, go find another career?
16, 17.
Okay.
It was like junior high
was
and
that
high
when you went to the Culinary Institute?
Yeah, right about the same time.
Ah, and so you walk into this beautiful school, fantastic facility, all these, you know, young people with white coats and chef hats and flames. And so what grabs you?
The hustle and
bustle. Because you were only doing the pancakes, right?
I was only doing the pancakes. There was that sense of artistry. I mean, at that point, also in high school, I was taking drafting classes. So I was designing and attention to detail, and penmanship, all that kind of. I had that artistic seed in me, mm-hmm. you know. But I was also doing into hard labor with my dad on the weekends. We'd do a lot of masonry work and carpentry. You know,
really?
So I had that this other side that was also an option for me.
Uh-huh.
So what grabbed me the most was, I think, the sense of urgency and the artistic aspect of it, and then being on your feet and having to move and have that pressure and the stress, I think, is what grabbed me early on.
You know,
but I had zero cooking skills.
You know what's really interesting? Jacques Pepin's father was a carpenter. André Sultner's father was a carpenter.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And I think Jacques Torres's father was a carpenter, too. Mm. And they all are very good. I mean, they all do woodworking still. And so I think it's taking a craft that can be an art, you know? Did you have that when your father and you did masonry together? You had to learn the craft, right?
You had to learn the craft of making the cement, batch of cement, and making the concrete. Then you had to. There was the hard labor of picking up the rocks and moving these rocks. And there was this. My dad has this eye for detail of selecting the stones and how to match them together and put everything together. And the finished product was art. It was definitely a good thing for the eye to see.
Do you think those seeds were?
I definitely think it benefited quite a bit and had an impact.
So tell me about going to school. Was it what you expected? Because had you worked in a restaurant before you went to school?
Before I enrolled at CIA, you were required to have worked in a restaurant for, I believe, like 3 months. So the only thing I could do, because I had zero experience, was my father got me into the kitchen at a corporate facility where he was working his day job, and it was serving lunch and sandwiches. And the chef that was running this corporate kitchen was also a CIA grad, so gave me some basics. Mm-hmm. Started to learn how to use a knife. But I entered the CIA with almost no experience. Mm-hmm. I was also, at that point, 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Recalling those years, I had zero experience. I will admit I was the worst in my class. I was
how
awful.
So? Why?
Oh, well, I took on the name of George Burns. For one, true story.
Because you have a great sense of humor.
Yeah, It was rough. I got my ass kicked. Period. I mean that.
Well, were you a wise ass, or were you just funny, or were you not taking it seriously?
I just didn't have an experience. I was trying to organize. I was organizing myself to the T. I was sharpening my knife at night while everybody else was out because I couldn't go out. I was too young to go to any of the bars or anything like that was happening. So I was preparing myself. I was green. I was greener than green.
And the classes were
difficult. Uh-huh. And you know, we had some really hardcore chefs that were disciplining us and teaching us. And I just there was students that had more experience than me that had worked in restaurants before that had a lot more experience. Period. And
so
I struggled.
Were you discouraged? Were you discouraged? I mean,
I didn't. I never gave up. There was a lot of sleepless nights. There was the walking home back to my dorm with my head down, just I suck, that kind of a thing. But I went back and did it every day. And I think what changed it all was my externship. And you know, and it was just all about the daily grind, going back and doing it again, failing, falling on your ass, getting back up and doing it back. Wait,
so where did you do your externship?
I went back to a classical French restaurant in Connecticut called the Stonehenge Inn and worked for Chef Bill Keating.
Mm-hmm. And what did you learn there? How was it different from school?
A lot of classical. I mean, it was taking the terminology, the fundamentals that I was taught at school and putting them into the real world, which mm-hmm. is important. And it was a continuation of classical French technique. You know, I had to tourner 150 potatoes for service and carrots.
Tell everybody what tourner means.
Tourner is, you know, taking a vegetable of sorts and carving it into a football type shape.
And why do they do that?
Classical French technique, beauty. You know, craftsmanship, art. You know,
how long
does
it take to make a little football?
It takes a lot of practice. A lot. I used to carve things that looked like who knows what odd shapes. Definitely not footballs until I really nailed it. But it was the day in and day out where I'd go into work an hour earlier, 2 hours earlier, just to practice the tourner vegetables because every dish at this time had tourner vegetables on there. So that was the first thing I learned to do, and then it was glazing vegetables properly and blanching vegetables and then learning how to make more stocks and sauces and finishing dishes and making pasta and the real basic technique. And what I was able to learn during my externship was speed, reacting to pressure, sense of urgency, the fundamentals of being a good line cook,
So
organization.
When you went back to the school after your externship, were you more confident? Were you empowered? And
I definitely, not to boost my ego, but I went back in and beat the crap out of other kids now.
Good for you. I
think it was all about determination and not giving up and practicing, period.
Right. So you don't have to be the best in your class. In fact, you know, the people who come in and are the best, sometimes their ego is so big, they don't allow their brain to learn. They're showing off.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so in a
those
sense.
Those are the people that don't know how to use salt, pepper, and don't know how to use.
They're not George Mendez. I bet they were not one of Food and Wine's best new chefs or whatever. But so where was your first?
I'm a cook at heart. Yeah. Sorry. Period.
where was your first job?
My first job was back at the Stonehenge Inn where I did my externship. And this is 1994. And then I went to a cooking class in Richfield, Connecticut that was being taught by Ed Brown, who back then was a chef at Tropica, who still is in New York City today.
He's a great chef.
He's fantastic, had a big impact in my career and taught me a lot of basic things, especially butchering fish. Taught me everything I knew about fish, period. And I was a butcher in his restaurant for a good span of a year. And then after that, I moved on to Boulay. And that's where things changed.
That is one of the seminal wellsprings of a great generation of chefs. So actually, we're going to take a little break here. Because
okay.
I think what goes on in Boulay's kitchen deserves more than a minute. So
yes.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Chef Story.
Thank you.
program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, my guest is George Mendez from Aldea Restaurant in New York City on West 17th Street. So, hi, George. We were just talking about you got out of culinary school. You did some time at the Stonehenge Inn in Connecticut, but you really came to your second learning experience at Boulay back in the mid-90s.
Yes.
And that was... that was a very, very important restaurant in New York City.
Very much so.
And so tell me about the atmosphere in that kitchen. How is it different from other kitchens, and why was it so important in your life?
I don't think it's that much different than any other restaurant of that caliber, of really high standards of excellence and consistency, and you know, performing at the four-star level every single day. The atmosphere was pressure to the max. It was cutthroat. It was about putting yourself to the test every day.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you're going in early in the morning if you wanted to be ready for service, and getting disciplined by David Blaine himself and you know, other seconds in command. And
so walk me through
rushing
that. Wait. Walk me through that.
Rushing through mise en place time to get ready for service is what it was. It was a race every day, which it can be also today.
Why is it? Was it so complex doing the techniques to get ready? Mise en place, for people out there, is the way you set up your station. You have to be ready, and so you have to prep a lot of pre-prep a lot of the food. So, you know, tell me about the pressure. You know, cutting carrots, is that pressure?
It's about precision and getting to the end product. You know, having a really sharp knife is the start of everything. You know, too many cooks come into the kitchen and they have a really expensive knife and it's not sharp. To me, it's useless. So, you know, I'd rather have a cheap knife that's really sharp. So, you know, back in those days at Boulay, you know, we'd have to do a lot of brunoise of carrot, for example. And, you know, it's a tedious job, but it builds your focus, builds your psyche, and gets you pumped up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's all about organization. But, you know, back then at Boulay, there was days where you didn't know what the menu was going to be at night. You know, David would put together a tasting menu at 4 o'clock that would then change at 5 o'clock. And a lot of times it was a guessing game. It was a chaos that resulted in inspiration.
Wow!
As complex as that may sound, it was like you thrived on. It's like, all right, you'd walk in, and be like, walk in 11 o'clock in the morning, and you're thinking, okay, this. I know we're gonna need this. I know we're gonna need that. You know, you want to get stuff on the stuff. You want to start cooking upstairs, but lunch service is still going on. So you're starting to organize this big sheet pan of what you're gonna do first and where you're going to get on the stove first. Then you go upstairs and you get into a fight with the fish cook because you want to borrow a little bit of his stove space, but he's still cooking his service. So it was a constant battle of trying to get ready.
tell me one thing. You know, Dan Barber was in your kitchen. You were
yes,
saying.
Awesome.
Who else was in? Who were just cooks
in the kitchen back then?
I
mean, it was great. You know, Dan Barber, Galen Zamora, Kirk Guttenbrunner, Cyril Renault, Alex Urena, just you know, and a bunch of French guys.
tell me a learning experience that you had there. Because Dan told me, you know, one of his experiences was David looked across the kitchen at him and started screaming at him, talk to your fish.
Yes. Classic story, right?
All right. So tell me about talking to your fish.
David is always telling everybody to talk to your fish, listen to your fish, listen to the vegetable, trust your palate, taste.
What does
that mean? It means become one with what you're doing. Being sensitive to smell, to touch, to really almost meditating on what you're doing.
Can you do that?
It takes a lot of time, but it's really about focus, mm-hmm. practice, and being sensitive to the work at hand is what it comes down to. And Dan Barber, that's a true story. I remember him saying that to Dan and to many of us. There was times where I remember a particular venison dish that was on the menu, and we had to cut these potatoes to a certain thickness, and for some reason, no matter how thin I cut them, they were still too thick for Dave, and he would shout at me across the stove and be like, "You're cutting potatoes for an 18-wheeler truck driver. You know, what are you doing?" And he didn't scream much, but he would just speak in a demeaning manner in a way at times. But it was at the same time there was horseplay. We spent 14 hours, 16 hours a day in that kitchen 6 days a week together. So it was one big happy family at times. there was fighting. There was a little bit of everything. But it was a crucial point in my career.
Do you remember a special dish that really had you look at food in a whole new way?
My time at Boulay was an introduction to a very light, herb-based cuisine and cooking with fresh clam juice, cooking with tomato water, making basil oil, parsley oil, chive oil, making vegetable purees to thicken sauces with. So it was a complete opposite of that classical French technique now. It was a very a fragrant, herbal, healthy style of cooking that I was introduced to. The flavors still were very explosive in retrospect when I look at it, but like the dish that's still a signature and you could probably have that Boulay tonight if you go there is the shellfish that he was doing in an oceanic herbal broth, tomato water, clam juice, all the purees that I just mentioned. It's an iconic dish of balance, of feels like you're in the ocean and tasting all this seafood and with those herbal notes at the end. And different textures of the shellfish. And that was a dish that you had to nail and be careful with making the sauce perfect every single time, or else it would turn brown, or the balance would be off and the acidity would be too high, or it was too bland. And cooking the shellfish, everything was cooked separately and brought together at the last minute. So it was a test, an example in attention to detail, in organization. Fundamental stuff.
Mm. So where did you go after Boulay?
I was lucky enough to set me up with a stage in Paris at Arpège.
A
three-star Michelin restaurant. At that time, I only had two, and I went back again when I got three Michelin stars.
That's Alain Passard.
Alain Passard. Right? Yeah. And he was another big influence in my career because he was one of the most creative chefs that I ever knew at that time and still is today. Vegetable-wise, and he would compose menus of still a lot of meat and fish, but individual vegetable dishes that I wasn't seeing much of at that point in my career. Mm. This is 1996, 97, and then into 1998 when I went back again. And he was, doing things like an onion gratin. He was, doing these things with tomatoes and making all these citrus powders, and I was introduced to fresh licorice roots for the first time. All these different aromas that were going on, and then the discipline of being in the kitchen at 9 o'clock in the morning in Paris and seeing the products that arrive, the freshness of and the different quality and the importance of accepting product of the highest quality was a training period again for me. At Boulay, I was introduced to the farmers already, and New York was already starting to grow with the Union Square Green Market, etc. But Paris was an integral, very important time for me, working for Alain Passard. Mm. And I was a stage there, and I spent a lot of time brooming the floor, cleaning a lot of chanterelles. And again, it was a lot of repetitive, monotonous work, but taught me, again, repetitive, the sum of many parts, the importance of of paying attention to little details of every single little task, whether it was mincing a shallot, peeling garlic, everything added up to a finished dish at some point or another. And I was able to be part of the service and ask questions, and, you know, in the little French that I knew, right at the pass in our Pedro's, a very small kitchen, which was very advantageous because everything was right in one spot. Monsieur Passar was at the pass, and then you had a fish cook, a meat cook, and other guy doing vegetables. So it was a team of five people. And when I look back in those days, the food that came out of the kitchen, and I think about it now, amazing. Mm. It was really amazing. The attention to detail, the stuff that came out of such a small environment. It doesn't matter how big your kitchen or the equipment that you have or any of that. It's about your work, your craft, your ingredients, your attention to detail. You could have a very basic dish of three ingredients, but it can sing off the plate if you paid attention and did it right, the right way, the way you were taught, with discipline and focus and passion and skill. Mm. And those are the key words. Those are key words to any chef and cook in training.
Wow.
Which I still think about a lot today.
You also work for Alain Ducasse, didn't
yes,
you?
In Provence.
In Provence.
For a shorter time.
Was that at the same time? You know, at the same period? Did you go
1999.
From Passar? Did you come back to the States after?
I came back to the States. Came back to the States. I did another, I think I spent another year at Boulay, actually. Mm-hmm. And then went to, I had a stint at a bistro, Le Zoo, back then. Which today is a Spotted Pig, and I was a chef of this small bistro when I was 25 years old, around that time. And then I decided
this was
that
after
I wanted
Boulay.
Yes.
And so you were the chef, so that meant you're doing the menus, and you had to hire the staff, and it was your.
I had to hire my kitchen staff, and I was yelling at a lot of people back then. I was a hothead. I was doing what I thought was very high quality food. And a menu that was the most expensive thing was $21. And I wanted to use foie gras here and there, but it could only be done on New Year's Eve. But I was doing a really, you know, at that time, I didn't have that many pockets to reach into as far as experience. And it was a time where I was starting to cultivate my style, but it was still not definitive yet. It was still more of, I was doing a lot of dishes that were not copies, but flavors that I knew worked because we did them at Boulay. You know, it was that time period for me. And then it was like, it was a great experience of starting to have that management role. And then I decided it was time for me to just keep training more. And I went to Washington, D.C. and worked at L'Espinasse for one of Alain Ducasse's disciples, Sandro Gamba. Sandro Gamba. And that was there for a year. He sent me to Ducasse and Roger Verger on the same trip. And that was a whole introduction.
How important is it for a young American chef to go to Europe and be exposed to those kitchens?
I think travel is important. I think you don't have to go to one particular kitchen, but I mean, back then that was the thing to do, is you need to go to France. You know, then soon after everybody needed to go to Spain, and now everybody has to go to the Nordic countries or to Peru or South America. So it was really about travel. At that time, it was still a learning period for me. So being in the kitchens of Ducasse and Roger Verger was, again, another lesson in discipline and classical technique.
Are those kitchens more disciplined than the Ducasse kitchen, L'Espinasse, or David Boulay's kitchen?
I think every chef has a different management style.
So it isn't so much the American-European divide. It's more the individual chef's style.
It's an individual chef's style. And I think when I traveled to those other countries, you know, France and then Spain in my later years, was about learning about different ingredients, different chefs' cooking styles. That was really what it was about.
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your style in Aldeia. And your Portuguese influences. We'll be
awesome.
Right back.
Thanks.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is George Mendez, the chef owner of Aldea Restaurant in New York City on West 17th Street. And now, after listening to your really incredible background and working for the very top chefs in the world, now, and you had your first chef's position, tell us about Aldea. When did you come to the idea that you were now ready to have your big restaurant, and how does that come about, and what's the philosophy?
Basically, it started, the seed was planted, or the idea of opening my own restaurant was when I was a chef de cuisine at Tocqueville in 2003 through 2006. I knew that it was time for me to make a name for myself and to show my own style, to come home as a chef.
So this is what year?
This is 2006.
And what year did you go to school? 1994?
I enrolled at CIA in 1991.
And graduated in
92.
Okay, so you waited 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years.
Great. All right, no. So I'm just putting that in perspective for all those young cooks out there that want to own their own restaurant in 2 years. You got to pay your dues, but go on, George.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
It was time for me to cook my own food. I started a little bit at Tocqueville and working for, you know, a fantastic couple, Joanne and Marco, running a mom-and-pop restaurant, and I learned a lot about customer service. And I was starting to do dishes of my own and starting to see what direction I wanted to take and what road I wanted to take. And I had a lot of inspirations through my training years, etc. People that had the biggest impact and steered me in the right direction was Ducasse. Boulet, of course, integrally and very important, but Ducasse and Martin Berasategui and Alain Passard, who were all, you know, cooking food that was inspired by their upbringing, by their family. Alain Passard had many dishes on the menu that were inspired by his grandmother. You know, Ducasse was cooking with a lot of Mediterranean ingredients that I was already familiar with. And I was starting to put all the pieces of the puzzle together now. And I asked myself, you know, what is it that has true meaning to me? Well, you know, what is food to me? You know, what attracts me? And I think food has to have, or what you're cooking has to have some cultural identity. And I started thinking about my upbringing. I started thinking about my roots. I started thinking about what I ate as a kid. And I just started going backwards. And I was inspired to start cooking with those flavors again and just start refining. And that was the definition of what I started to do at Aldea, was a style of cooking that was rustic yet refined. And that's how I define it till today. Everybody asks me, what kind of style do you cook, or what is Aldea? It's a refined rusticity. And people say, well, that's contradiction. And I say, well, yes, it is. But, you know, it's about paying homage to honest flavors and old traditional recipes and inspirations and refining everything, but also having a free spirit. I think a chef has to have a little bit of, it's that, in French, je ne sais quoi, but it's like you go down this road where you develop your own style, and it's like a little bit of humor. It's a little bit of whimsical. It's like, I don't know, it just comes from whatever inspires you at the moment. But what helped me define it more was Portuguese history, that we had former colonies all over the world. And that's what drives me today. You know, the flavors of Goa, the flavors of Brazil, you know, were former Portuguese colonies, Macau, China. You know, we were seafarers throughout the 15th century, and that's really important for me. Yeah. And that gives me the reason, it gives me the validity to say, hey, you know what, I can cook like this because this is who we are. And
tell me about your menu right now. So give us an insight to how this manifests itself.
Well, going back to when Aldea first opened, I put together, it was Portuguese flavors, you know, cooking with octopus, it was shellfish, it was a lot of olive oil, it was salt cod. You know, the repertoire goes on and on and on, but I'll use our duck rice as an example. I'm sitting at the chef's counter the night before we're opening for friends and family, and I wanted to just add one more little dish, and I want to do something with duck. And I just said, hey, I don't want to do a traditional, you know, roasted duck breast or carve it and slice it and serve it with a fruit sauce or whatever. And I wanted to do something more peasant, more real, and not show-offy. And I just started to take a traditional rice dish of Portugal, the arroz pato, and that's how it started. And I just said, okay, what can we do to make this dish better? You know, I read the original recipe, and it was like, find a duck, kill the duck, pluck the feathers, drain it, and then put it in a pot, boil it with water, rice, add chorizo, on and on and on. And then I just went back, and it's a lot of classical French technique in there. It's duck confit, it's modern technique cooking sous vide, it's everything comes together in a rice dish. And that's how it was born. And there's a lot of textures with crackling skin, and that's how Aldea's menu.
How much new technology do you use in your cooking?
I mean, it's maybe anywhere between 30 to 40%. I can't really say. I think it's important for a chef to know the basics, yet evolve and embrace modern technologies and keep growing with it and always have that open mind and always think, hey, how can this be better? Mm. It's really important to first know the fundamentals. The fundamentals are of utmost importance before you learn how to use xanthan gum, for example. Can't emphasize that more. I just cannot. It's crucial. You know, I'd rather have you know how to make a nice green salad for me than to show off with some kind of electrocolloid.
Is one of the hardest things to do properly.
Yes.
To me, when I go into a restaurant, and it could be a very fancy restaurant, and people say, well, what are you going to order? And I'll say, I'll have the salad. People say, you're in such a great restaurant. Why are you going to waste, you know, your first course on a salad? Don't you want the fancy whatever?
And yeah, but who doesn't like a green salad?
No, but to perfectly dress a green leaf, to
yes.
perfectly wash it, to have it crisp, the right temperature.
Yes.
And then to balance a delicious vinaigrette that doesn't take away from the lettuce leaf,
yes.
doesn't laden it down.
Right.
Just sort of dresses it. And then the right seasoning of salt or whatever, and then to make it creative.
Right.
To me, that's the hardest. It's the way I judge a chef, quite frankly.
Right. And you said something very important there at the beginning, washing the lettuce.
Yes.
You know how many cooks are, you know, will come in and be like, they'll start to do something and they don't even wash the vegetables or wash the lettuce. It's so important.
Really. So now, tell me about the relationship. You are the chef owner of this restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just you cooking in the back and making the menu.
I wish it was.
Why? Elaborate.
I'm a cook at heart, and that's what I love about it. Granted, I love the restaurant industry, and that's the reason why I have a restaurant today. But, you know, to run a restaurant, it's a challenge every day that I thrive on, that comes with years of experience and love for the industry, for customers. Mm. It's a hospitality industry, and that's what we're doing every day. We're serving customers.
So what kind of atmosphere do you want in your front of house? You know, we're out in the restaurant.
Is your
personality, just like you're imbuing the menu with your flavors,
how
do you imbue your personality in the room?
I think Aldea, we operate with a very professional service, yet with an unbuttoned collar, with jeans on, with a very almost personable service, but, you know, loud music. I just love that, you know, relaxed atmosphere. I want it to be fun. I want the customer to smile and have a good time and be able to laugh loudly.
What kind of customer do you like? I mean, do you want somebody who knows a lot about food, or do you want somebody who wants to discover?
I want people that come into Aldea with an open mind, hungry, and adventurous in a way. I want to be able to just fulfill their needs and nourish them. You know, that's the number one thing. It's like the food has to be great, the service has to be great, but I want them to be entertained and have a good time. And to me, I'm happy going home at night when I see the customer smiled, number one, and had a good time, and receive a compliment, hopefully, that says the food was delicious. And thank you, I'll be back again soon. That's to me is very important.
What's your favorite cocktail?
Oh, I'm not much of a cocktail person. You know, I'm really simple. you know, I love good beer and the occasional, you know, sip of good tequila. That's it.
Oh.
Yep.
How about wine?
I love wine as well. I mean, I'm a big Portuguese wine fanatic.
Tell us about Portuguese. What distinguishes Portuguese wine from French wine or American
wine? We have a lot of obscure, unique grapes like Torriga Nacional. We have, you know, different, like Vinho Verde, a lot of unripe grape wines made of very unique rustic wines, but also, you know, spritzy wines, very floral. I mean, there's some similarity, but I think when you taste Portuguese red wines versus, you know, French, there's much more of a rustic note in general.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a sommelier by trade. I can't really distinguish, you know, sit here and talk about that too much, but wine, the Portuguese wine, I feel is still very underrated. There's a lot of delicious bargains out there.
I bet, yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm proud to say that Aldea, with our wine list having, you know, 60% of it is Portuguese / Spanish, and then the other rest is France and America. And happy to say that everything we sell is mostly Portuguese.
So
we're educating the customer, and you know, and they'll walk in and be like, you know what, I love Pinot Noir, and we'll give you this Esporão from the Alentejo region of Portugal, and that's really fun.
So what are some of your dreams? You've accomplished so much at an early age. What is
I'm
still
not that young.
Well, everything is relative, George. Yes, I'm sitting on the
true.
Other side of the table.
Okay. By the way, I'm so happy to be here with you. This is an honor. When I was invited, I was like, what, Dorothy Hamilton? Come on.
Oh.
I'm really happy. Thank you so much.
I'm just a chef groupie. That's all, you know. So tell me, what are the things that still, you know, you dream about, challenges, you know, mountain peaks to climb?
Well, you know, Aldea itself, I feel, is still a baby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's barely 4 years old, and I still have a lot of goals set for it. And there's other restaurant in the horizon. You know, I'm working on the cookbook already as well. And
is that something a chef has to do today?
No, it's not something you have to do. I think I really want to educate mass America, then hopefully the world, what Portuguese cooking is about. And, you know, the George Mendes / Aldea story.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important one to tell. It's the main focus, you know, but really, you know, really showing, you know, the savvy home cook and also the chef. It's the book is going to be a lot of photos. It's something that you want to have on your coffee table, but also a lot of basic recipes, but also a lot of Aldea driven recipes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a message. It's something that I just want to use as a tool, mm-hmm. and say, hey, this is Portuguese cooking and this is what it can be. And this is my story of how I became a chef.
You know what I would love for you to do is convince the Portuguese government to give you the money to do a PBS series, you know, like 12 shows on food and wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically that's the way it works, folks. You know, you get a sponsor and they pay for the production.
Right.
And then you kind of sell it to PBS. But if it's a really great show, they love those kinds of cooking shows. That would be so interesting because I'm sitting here feeling very uneducated of what to even ask you about Portuguese food. It's not something
I'm here to tell you.
We Americans know very well.
Right.
So
it's so similar.
Get that book going.
Yeah. It's coming.
So tell me one last thing. How important is old technique versus new technique in your cooking? You know, the classic technique versus some of this modern. I know you're one of the chefs who really bridge that very well. You use modern technology for the highest and best purpose, taste.
You know, correct. Taste, at the end of the day, is the most important thing. It's important, again, as I said earlier in the program, it's the fundamentals, but bridging them together, they work hand in hand. They're integral. They work great together. And there's instances where I will use anthem gum to thicken a sauce, and there'll be days where I'm thickening it with
that
just
olive
oil. That
sounds so disgusting, anthem gum.
Right.
Is it a gum? Let's explain to people what it is.
It's based on a bacteria. I don't want to get into it
too much.
Bacteria? It's based on a bacteria. It's natural. That's probably sitting on your shoulder right now. It's not. You know, it's a natural. I don't want to. There's people out there that I can talk about it a lot better than I can, like my friend Dave Arnold and Wiley. It's like I use it. I know how to use it. But there's days where I just use olive oil, or there's days where I just use a vegetable puree. and the occasional creme fraiche or cream into the wild. Those things are not banned from my kitchen. So I think it's important to know how to use it first and what it does and how it tastes and what the result is and how to use it properly. Educate yourself how to use it properly is the number one thing. There's so many books out there.
Can I ask a stupid question? What does it do?
Thickens.
Oh, okay. It's a thickener. It's like cornstarch.
Yes.
So if it had a name like cornstarch, we'd probably...
Sounds a little better.
Yeah. Than right. Xanthan gum?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Do you think it's here to stay?
Yes. I think it's here to stay, and I think there's more to come.
Okay. Let's chew on that.
Yes.
Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome.
And I want to say, obrigada.
De nada. Igualmente, un prazer. Obrigado, Dorothy.
Thank you.
Nada.
And we'll see you next time. You've been listening to Chef's Story, and I'd like to thank Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen, my producers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.